Hello and welcome to the Rank the Albums podcast, the podcast in which I rank the albums of popular artists and inevitably at some point not so popular artists. This time I'm looking at David Bowie, or as I call him, David Bowie, which you're just going to have to get used to. He has quite a chunky discography, of which I'll be ranking his studio albums, all 25 of them. Caveat time, here's what I won't be including in the rankings. His soundtracks for the film Labyrinth and for the four-part television serial The Buddha of Suburbia. Mercifully, I won't be reviewing his albums with Tin Machine, that's his late 80s alternative rock band. I won't be ranking the albums he produced for and co-wrote with Iggy Pop, both released in 1977. The Idiot and Lust for Life are both essential, and they would definitely be in the top 10 had they been credited to Bowie, but they're not. So they aren't. Honourable mentions to the albums Bowie produced or co-produced, like All the Young Dudes by Mott the Hoople, Raw Power by Iggy and Stooges, and Transformer by Lou Reed. All of these are from Bowie's very prolific 1972-1973 period and are all great. But yeah, those aren't included. Those aren't included, nor are Bowie's various live albums. So let's move on to the actual rankings now. Obviously, starting with The Stinkers, the bad, inexcusable albums. At 25, we have Black Tie, White Noise from 1993. This is Bowie's house record, as in the genre house. It's weirdly very bland. It has some good sax parts on it, but otherwise this is a very forgettable, dated affair with very little to redeem it. At 24, we have Earthling. This is from 1997, and it's Bowie's attempt at industrial music, jungle, drum and bass. Like Black Tie, White Noise, it's a desperate bid to sound modern and contemporary and relevant. Most songs sound like he's written a bland tune and stuck a drum and bass track behind it. The exception is 7 Years in Tibet, which has some nice jazzy bits in the verse and some more heavy chords on the chorus. But to be honest, Earthling sounds a bit like he's trying to keep up with the cool kids, be all current and experimental, and he fails abysmally, and it's got a crap album cover too. At 23, we have the album that Bowie himself calls his nadir, and from his Phil Collins phase. That's Never Let Me Down from 1987. It has a couple of decent tracks, Time Will Crawl and the title track Never Let Me Down. The former was written in response to the Chernobyl disaster. But otherwise, it's just a soulless album. Bowie seems so uninterested in making music by this point. There's none of the eccentricities that the man's known for. It's very 1980s. But that's not the problem. The lack of tunes is the problem. At 22, we have another from his Phil Collins era. This is 1984's Tonight. Again, uninspired, lacking in creativity, very 80s production. There's some cod reggae-inspired tracks and cheesy horns, backing vocals. You can picture Bowie with a perm and shoulder pads during the whole record, and it's grotesque. God Only Knows what he was thinking with his cover of God Only Knows by the Beach Boys originally. Bowie also does a few tracks he wrote originally with Iggy Pop, and he completely ruins them, which, you know, is a novel case of murdering your own tunes. There's a couple of decent tracks on Tonight which mean it ranks higher in the rankings. You've got the 7-minute opener, Loving the Alien, and the single Blue Jean. These at least bring a bit of songwriting nous to the album, and they aren't completely trashed by the 80s production, but yeah, Tonight is best avoided. So now we're moving on to the curious albums. I think by curious I mean still mainly bad, but at least these ones are interesting. So the next two albums are his first two albums, both titled David Bowie. At number 21 we have his second album called David Bowie from 1969. This is sometimes called Space Oddity after its lead track, which is iconic, really the first classic Bowie track. It's spacey, tense, melodic, chilling. And the rest of the album doesn't measure up to Space Oddity. It's an album where Bowie can't decide whether he wants to be a psychedelic folky or a rock star. So it ends up being a real mixed bag of styles and of its time. It has loads of pretentious lyrics, boring, elongated jams, and a lack of real focus. I do like the haunting acoustic track, Letter to Hermione. This is a bitter song written about an ex who dumped him. It's got quite an unusually personal and direct lyric from Bowie. And you do actually sense he was quite wounded by the experience. So it's quite an unusual one in his discography. There's also Memory of a Free Festival, which starts with Bowie just on a cheapo organ bought from Woolworths. And I'm not making that up. And then it kind of turns into this happy, clappy, hippie sing-along, kind of like Hey Jude. It's actually much better than I've just described it. But yeah, overall, this album leaves a lot to be desired. At number 20, we have David Bowie's self-titled debut from 1967. This album doesn't really resemble anything else in his catalogue. His voice is very mannered, it's very cockney, kind of, shine your shoes, Gavner! And the album has quite a light entertainment music hall style. There's plenty of quirky, cheeky, chappy, chirpy storytelling on this album. But the songs have subjects which include cannibalism, for instance, and a song about a grave digger. I think there's a song about abortion too, so it's quite dark in places. It's primarily interesting because it's so far away from the whole Ziggy Stardust rock star persona that we all know him from at this stage. There's flourishes of early British psychedelia. The band occasionally flirt with rockier arrangements, but yeah, it's very stylized and very kind of old-fashioned. And it's more interesting than actually good. And you can tell how artificial this performance is because you can bear in mind in the years before this, he was doing these kind of blues covers, raunchy blues covers in clubs. So his persona as a cheeky chappy on this album is completely superficial, but it kind of foreshadows his later personas. At number 19, we have Pinups from 1973. This is his last album with The Spiders from Mars, the backing band that were on Ziggy Stardust. Pinups is a covers album of Bowie's favourite tracks from the mid-60s, kind of the period I was just talking about, so sort of 1964 to 67. So you've got covers of The Who, The Kinks, early Syd Barrett-era Pink Floyd, but also lesser-known British blues bands like The Pretty Things. And it's a great idea on paper, but the execution is off. It feels very rushed. The production is very inattentive. And if you consider like how much of a role Bowie was on up until this point, considering his previous three albums, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, this feels like such a rush job to satisfy his record label. It's not terrible as an album, it's just disappointing. It does have a good cover of Here Comes the Night from Van Morrison's 1960s band Them. The cover of Sorrow is also pretty good, but this album is a misstep. As I will keep repeating throughout this podcast, Bowie wasn't much good at covers generally, and a whole album of them is a bit much. So at number 18, we have number one, Outside, which bears the subtitle The Diary of Nathan Adler or The Art Ritual Murder of Baby Grace Blue, a non-linear gothic drama hypercycle. So, obviously, that subtitle is long and pretentious. Just like this album, really. It's actually a better album than most of his abysmal mid-80s to late 90s period, partly because it reunites him with Brian Eno, who collaborated on his so-called Berlin trilogy in the 1970s. Also back on board is Carlos Alomar, who plays guitar on many of his 70s and 80s albums, and Mike Garson, the fantastic pianist, who collaborates with Bowie sporadically from the early 70s onwards. So by working with these tried and trusted collaborators, he doesn't let bland session musicians dominate the album. There's still industrial elements and dated production like his other 90s albums, but Eno makes sure there's plenty of interesting textures to offset the album's limitations. There aren't many tunes, admittedly, but the album's not really aiming for that. It's aiming for texture and to tell a story. Even if that narrative is bewildering and written from numerous perspectives. There are these weird but entertaining interludes where Bowie performs a range of bizarre voices. But yeah, it's something like an hour long and not in any way accessible, so I'll file Outside under curious rather than good. Okay, so the next four albums belong in a different category. I'd say they are solid but safe. And solid and safe isn't too bad a thing when you consider that Bowie's 80s were very soulless and the 90s had lots of failed experiments. And so in 1999 he releases the album Hours, which is my pick for number 17. It's a competent album, despite its truly awful artwork. It depicts dead Bowie being cradled by bored Bowie in a world where clip art fonts and barcodes have taken over. And you can look it up if you don't believe me. The worst thing about this album, though, is that some of the songs almost sound like they're becoming songs by the Lighthouse Family. But there's a return to safe, solid songcraft with tunes like Something in the Air and The Pretty Things Are Going to Hell. So, yeah, it's all right, this one. At number 16, it's his next record, his first of the new millennium. That's 2002's Heathen. The sound harks back to his 70s stuff, but it's not obvious enough to make it a pale rehash. It has a couple of great slow-burning tracks, including the track Slow Burn, appropriately enough, and the opener Sunday. His covers of Cactus by The Pixies and I've Been Waiting For You, originally by Neil Young, are among his better covers, but this album fizzles out towards the end. At number 15, it's his next record after that. It's 2003's Reality. It's pretty similar territory to Heathen. He isn't pushing the boat out experimentally. He's just producing a solid classic rock record to keep his hand to keep his hands busy. Yeah, I didn't mean to say that. To keep his fans happy and succeeding at it on his own terms. The opener, New Killer Star, is a really strong track, as is the nostalgic late night lounge jazz closer, Bring Me the Disco King, which is really worth checking out. At 14, and sorry, this section is very chronological, it's his next album, which was released after a 10-year absence. It's 2013's release, The Next Day. And the first half of this record is quality. It's got the opener and title track, which kicks off things really energetically. You've got Dirty Boys, which struts along sulkily. You've got The Stars Are Out Tonight and Valentine's Day, which are really catchy, well-written pop rock tracks. The somber, nostalgic ballad, Where Are We Now? That's the album's centrepiece, and it's kind of a subtle epic. Just the second half of the album drags, unfortunately. And I think if the Next Day was kept short and sweet, like his next album, Black Star, just that, you know, kind of 7, 8, 9 tracks long, I'd rate it much higher. But yeah, it's just, it outstays its welcome. Okay, so the next three albums on the list can be classified as good but flawed genre exercises. At 13, we have Young Americans from 1975. It's his decisive move away from rock and roll, instead bringing what he described as a plastic soul sound to the table. It's a warm, well-produced album, and you definitely get the sense that Bowie genuinely adores soul music. The backing vocalists, who include Luther Vandross, they're really great throughout. The opening track for me is one of his more overrated big tunes, but I can still see its appeal. The first side tracks like Win, Fascination and Right are all really good, and you see Bowie take on soul convincingly. And not at all predictably, it's just the second half of the record drags and it becomes a bit samey, especially with Bowie's uninspired cover of Across the Universe, written by John Lennon of the Beatles, of course. Lennon co-wrote and appears on the final track, Fame, which really saves this album. It's a funky, slightly discordant, but brilliant track that points towards the sound of his next album, Station to Station. Then at number 12, we have Let's Dance. This is Bowie's commercial blockbuster album from 1983, which brought him many new fans and by extension, sales. After he spent the late 70s producing experimental alternative rock albums, he started to miss the mainstream, so he signed up to EMI Records on a lucrative contract, and he decided to work with Nile Rodgers of Chic fame, kind of a hitmaker supreme, if you like, and he's set to make out an album of hits, and he succeeds gloriously with Modern Love, which is joyous. You've got the title track, Let's Dance, which appears on the album in an extended version. I think it's about 7 minutes long, and that's excellent too. Less successfully for me, you have China Girl, which is a, like with Tonight, it's another Iggy Pop song that Bowie co-wrote in the 70s. This was another hit, but personally I much prefer the Iggy version. I think Bowie's version is pretty cheesy. More successfully, there's a remake of a song that Bowie wrote with Giorgio Moroder for the 1981 film Cat People. The song's called Cat People Putting Out Fire. The original from 81 is a 6 minute slow burn of a track, and the second version for Let's Dance is a much different arrangement. It's kind of more punchy and new wave. I actually really like both versions, although the 83 version is generally seen as kind of lacking the tension of the original. Otherwise, Let's Dance has a few tunes like Without You and Criminal World that kind of breeze along inoffensively. So I feel like it's maybe a bit generous to rate this album too highly because it doesn't have wall-to-wall bangers, but it does have a few. But I feel like this album really succeeds on its own terms as a very modern, well, for the time, very slick-sounding pop record that successfully reached new audiences, and yeah, it has these moments of brilliance on too. At number 11, we have Bowie's third record, The Man Who Sold the World. This is from 1970. Bowie wears a dress on the cover of the UK version of the album, but that was too controversial for the Americans, so on the US version of the album, instead there's a cartoon of a cowboy. As I said before, on the 1969 David Bowie album, he kind of flirted with heavy rock unconvincingly. With this album, he throws himself into the deep end of that genre with much more satisfying results. 1970 was around the time of early Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, so he's kind of riding the wave of the early heavy rock scene, heavy metal scene on this. This is the first album he does with Mick Ronson as his guitarist, who subsequently appeared on Ziggy Stardust. His producer, Tony Visconti, plays bass, but actually doesn't produce this album that well. It suffers from quite a bad mix, unsuited to the genre. The guitars and drums sound tinny and feeble, especially on the opener, The Width of a Circle. This is a multi-part rocker that really should pack a punch. So it's a shame about the production, but this album, songwriting-wise, is a real step up from his first two records. My favourites are the eerie title track, The Man Who Sold the World, and All the Mad Men is also just a really great track. You've got Black Country Rock, in which Bowie gives an amusing impression of his contemporary Mark Bolan and his strangled singing. So this album's a lot of fun. It's not a heavy rock classic by any means, and I don't think Bowie ever really did heavy rock that convincingly, and you can feel free to listen to Tin Machine if you want further proof of that. But The Man Who Sold the World is the first of his 70s albums, and by extension, the first of his classic period, so well worth listening to. The next albums on the list are a couple that are good, occasionally great, but mostly challenging experimental albums. At number 10, I've gone for Scary Monsters and Super Creeps from 1980. So by this point, Brian Eno is no longer working with David Bowie, having been his chief collaborator for the previous three albums. However, the sound of this album is dominated by another collaborator from the Berlin Trilogy, Robert Thripp. His discordant guitar playing ranges from the thrilling to the headache-inducing. The first half of Scary Monsters is excellent. It kind of balances this poppy accessibility with the artiness he'd kind of been known for with real skill. So this is best exemplified by the sublime singles Ashes to Ashes and Fashion. But you've also got the Rollercoaster title track, in which Bowie adopts the voice of this cockney underworld villain. And Up the Hill Backwards is kind of an off-kilter pop song. It's an inventive, interesting first half. But as I say, Fripp gets really annoying on this album, frankly. The tracks on the second side are fine, but relatively lacking the sharpness and the dynamism of the verse side. And the sound of the record ends up sounding a little bit uniform, and perhaps being a bit harsh, but I'm going to have to be. Bowie's previous album from 1979 is at number 9. This is Lodger, Bowie's third with Brian Eno as his chief collaborator, and third in the so-called Berlin Trilogy, even though it was recorded in Switzerland. A bugbear of mine is that they didn't describe the trilogy as the Eno trilogy, because that's a more accurate description. But hey, anyway, Lodger, while the weakest of the Eno trilogy, in my opinion, it's one of Bowie's most underrated records. It is quite a challenging one, but it's full of curiosities and innovation, and it rewards repeated listens. You've got the slow burn ballad Fantastic Voyage, which opens things in quite an understated and misleading fashion. Bowie has a really powerful vocal that kind of creeps up on you on that one. You've got Red Sails, which is this really camp krautrock homage, and you can hear its influence on Adam and the Ants. And the album's second half is where the album steps up, though. You've got DJ, which is a Talking Heads tribute. Look Back in Anger is really frenzied and frenetic. You've got Boys Keep Swinging, in which Carlos Alomar plays drums, and I believe the drummer plays bass. So it sounds a little bit off, but it works really well. Kind of has a garage rock feel to it. And it utilises the same chords of Fantastic Voyage, so it kind of has this continuity from earlier in the album. You've also got Repetition, which is a very dark song about domestic abuse, and Red Money, which is this rewrite of Iggy and Bowie's Sister Midnight, which appears on the Idiot album. A few tracks kind of put people off on the first side, which are like African Night Flight, Move On, and The Assassin, and these have more of a worldly influence. And these tracks are very hard to get into. I think they're quite off-putting. They definitely point towards Eno's work with David Byrne on My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. But yeah, don't let those tracks put you off. Lodger is a really fascinating listen, and yeah, worth your time. So the next four albums I'm going to put in the great but not quite classics category. This is the section of the list where ordering the albums becomes really tricky, but at number eight I've gone for Diamond Dogs from 1974. Interestingly, while Bowie did co-produce a few of his records, I think this is the only one that he self-produced, and he plays a lot of the instruments and plays all of the guitar work here, having unceremoniously got rid of Mick Ronson. And Ronson isn't missed on this album, because Bowie's raw guitar playing really gives this record a different kind of bite. Originally, this album was intended to be a musical based on George Orwell's 1984. That was until Sonia Orwell refused to let Bowie have the rights, so Bowie, having already written tracks like Big Brother, We Are the Dead, and 1984, had to kind of recalibrate his original plans into an album where he kind of imagines his own post-apocalyptic world. And I think in that context, this album holds up remarkably well. All the tracks flow into each other really well. The title track, which is quite a Rolling Stones-esque track, is a big song from the album, as is Rebel Rebel, which is one of Bowie's most famous tracks, of course. Similar Stonesy vibe. The medley of songs Sweet Thing, Candidate, then the reprise of Sweet Thing is an ambitious, theatrical, quite dense piece that for me is the highlight of the record. The second side illustrates how much of a transitional album this is, so while tracks like Rebel Rebel seem like the last gasp of Bowie's glam rock phase, the second side hints towards the Plastic Soul sound of Young Americans. You've got Rock and Roll With Me, which is a soul ballad, which is a weak track for me, but interesting at least. Far superior is We Are the Dead, which has an especially great chord progression. 1984 is disco before disco was cool. So Diamond Dogs tends to get overlooked as a Bowie record, but it has a great sound. Most of the tracks are strong, really dirty sound, befitting of the post-apocalyptic world that it's describing. At number seven, we have Heroes from 1977, the second of the Berlin trilogy. This album kind of follows the formula set by Lowe, in the sense that it's got more upbeat, experimental songs on the first side, and then the second has mostly moody instrumentals. This album perhaps suffers in comparison to Lowe. There's also a lot of Robert Fripp's guitar on the first side. So if you listen to the tracks individually, his playing is great, but like on Scary Monsters, it becomes a little annoying after a while. That said, there's a real party atmosphere on tracks like Beauty and the Beast and Blackout. It's not too far removed from Station to Station's vibe in that respect. The thing with the album is that a lot of it is overshadowed by the title track, Heroes, which, of course, is a career highlight for Bowie. And Eno and Fripp particularly provide this amazing sonic landscape for Bowie's impassioned vocal, which expresses the adversity felt by two star-crossed lovers in divided Berlin. And I don't think anything else on Heroes comes close to Heroes. This next choice agonises me because this record is Bowie's most emotional, his most heartbreaking record. At number six, it's his swan song, Black Star, from 2016. And I must confess, I didn't truly appreciate this record when it came out. It was just 2 days after his death in 2016. But after a few years now, and while compiling this list, I'm actually quite worried that I'm being too conservative placing it so low. No album I can think of was written by a dying man or woman really comes close to this. And for this record, he abandoned the backing band that he'd worked with on his previous 21st Century albums, from Hours, I think, to The Next Day. And he instead goes with Donny McCaslin's jazz quintet, who are relatively unknown. And it's kind of a typical risk-taking move from Bowie, but I think his judgment pays off handsomely. They play really well on his album. Previously, perhaps I was dismissive of the tracks Sue in Season of Crime and Tis a Pity She Was a Whore. Both of these were released for the 2014 compilation album Nothing Has Changed, and they're kind of faster paced and break up what would otherwise be quite a somber affair, so they're quite valuable to the flow of the album. The title track is a 10-minute opus. It's quite jazzy, electronic. His vocal sound like a latter-day Scott Walker. And, yeah, it ends up turning into this, like, bluesier, jazzier track and then going back to electronica again. The third track, Lazarus, with its chilling and knowing first line, "Look up here, I'm in heaven." This is an amazing highlight of the record. For me, it's in his top 10 tracks ever. I love the distorted bluesy guitar over the supple, light bass riff, and the saxophones weave into the mix as it builds wonderfully. I love how this record features elements of Bowie's past, but he's not too overt about it. I'm kind of thinking of the weird drum and bass experiments of the 90s, the saxophones that appear on most of his albums. And I think this album is kept at 7 tracks for maximum impact. There's not much fat to be trimmed with this collection. And with this album, he brings the mystery of Bowie back. He seems to remember that it's his enigmatic nature that makes him so attractive. Bowie's lyrics are very serious in their reflections on mortality, but also playful in how he communicates with his audience. I find it hard to judge whether this album will be dated and dull in 20 years' time, but I doubt it. I think it's a fine swan song, and I hope one day I'll be more confident to rank it as a bona fide classic. Now it feels weird to move on to number 5, which is Aladdin Sane from 1973. It's certainly not as emotional as Black Star, but it is classic Bowie from Bowie's classic glam period. He described it as Ziggy Goes to America, and it kind of expands upon Ziggy's sound with backing singers, louder guitars, more percussion. Mike Garson, Bowie's pianist, shines on this album. He perfectly captures this very opulent, avant-garde, twinkly piano style, which is performed to great effect on the title track, and then on the luxurious closing track, Lady Grinning Soul. Mick Ronson is also terrific, particularly when knocking out these raunchy grooves, like on the sexually charged song Cracked Actor. You have Driving Saturday, which is another glam anthem, and Panic in Detroit, which has a great paranoid groove. The cabaret style track Time kind of outstays its welcome for me. And Bowie's cover of Let's Spend the Night Together by the Rolling Stones is horrendous. But then the Gene Genie comes along as a reminder that Bowie can outdo the Stones anyway. It's a shame that Bowie left off his version of All the Young Dudes, which he wrote for Mötley Hoople. That was recorded for the Aladdin Sane sessions. But yeah, this album, it may miss the cohesion of his very best records, and its cover is its most famous element, but still, this is an excellent collection of classic Bowie tracks. Okay, top 4 now. Now, these are the indisputable classics. All four represent the best of Bowie's creativity and ingenuity. Second, third, and fourth place, I mean, these albums are basically on a par, and I struggle to decide where to put them. But for the purpose of this list, I must. So at number four, I've gone for Station to Station from 1976. This is Bowie's cocaine-fueled funk monster of an album. He's under the guise of his Thin White Duke persona at this stage. It starts with the epic title track with its synthetic mimicry of a train, a two-note piano riff and wailing guitar feedback. It's got these big heavy drums and a funky riff that dominate for 5 minutes, and it sounds like the world's worst come down. But what's so magical about this track is you know what's coming. There's this middle section of the song where there's about 30 different chords that kind of escalate the mood of the song, and then it kind of has this ecstatic, bouncing, funky payoff with Bowie singing, "It's not the side effects of the cocaine, I'm thinking it must be love." And like Heroes, this song towers above the rest of the album that it appears on. But I think this album is more consistently great than Heroes. You've got Golden Years, which is a fine single, Word on a Wing, a soul ballad that exceeds anything on Young Americans. TVC15 is manic. It's kind of got this Dixie-esque piano riff and a lyric about a TV that swallows you whole. Stay is a killer, harsh funk tune. Wild as the Wind rounds off the album stylishly. Yeah, Station to Station is just six tracks of consistent brilliance. And the production on this album, you can just kind of, I don't know, you can just kind of smell the coke. But compared to most Drugs albums, it's very economical. It's not excessive at all. It's not pretentious. And it's kind of just ecstatic. It sounds like a night out that's about to come off the rails and soon verge into very dangerous territory, but it's a thrill all the same. At number three, we have Low from 1977. So after Bowie's cocaine-addled phase that I've just described, he sought to live a clean life in Berlin, West Germany at the time. And the album title reflects his low moods. He worked on The Idiot in mid-1976 with Iggy Pop, and he devoured the music of Kraftwerk, Neu and Harmonium, and he kind of learned to appreciate their approach to texture and electronics and to making cutting-edge albums. He teamed up with Brian Eno for the first time, but he retains Carlos Alomar and the backing band from Station to Station. Low is deliberately split into two. You've got Side A, which features short, spiky, electronic but poppy tunes, and Side B is influenced more by Eno's ambient music and is mostly instrumental. Side A is just revolutionary. I think the songs are punchy, they're still very strange, and they have very fascinating production and textures. They're very bluesy in an abstract way too, especially on Breaking Glass. And the first seven tracks, Roll Along, Sounds and Vision, A Career Highlight, Be My Wife and Speed of Life, are both built on layer after layer of electronic processed instruments. And you've got this drum sound, which is delayed and distinctive. With Side B, it's almost as if you're listening to a completely different record. And I think Fasora and Subterraneans are absolutely haunting compositions with their icy, hypnotic electronic soundscapes. On its own terms, this record is a huge success. It was a huge risk creatively for Bowie, but even now it sounds otherworldly, cerebral, way ahead of its time. And so yeah, it's Bowie's best experimental record and one of his great achievements. Once upon a time I would have said this is my favourite, but because the record emphasises texture over songcraft and has a few weaker tracks like Weeping Wall, I'm going to put it at number three. I'd rank Low a little higher than this one in the past. This next one is Hunky Dory from 1971. It's Bowie's singer-songwriter album, but he's far too weird to knock out confessional, earnest tunes he'd rather sing about occultism. And Hunky Dory has a few weaker tracks, which kind of meant I downgraded it in the past, but now I realise these serve a purpose. There's a lot of big, minor key, enigmatic tracks on this album, with strange, alarming, disconcerting lyrics. I'm thinking Life on Mars, Quicksand, the Bewley Brothers. So I've realised that the weaker tracks like the Zany and Twee, Kooks and Fill Your Heart, they're kind of intelligently placed in the track listing to give light relief at exactly the right moments. You've got Changes, Oh You Pretty Things and Life on Mars, which would be one of the best three opening tracks of any album were it not for Eight Line Poem, which is kind of an interlude track. But there's value in the track because it allows the album a moment to breathe. Queen Bitch, the Velvet Underground tribute, is the only real out-and-out rock song on the record. As a thrilling penultimate track, it kind of gives the album a second wind at exactly the right time. And it's interesting that Bowie repeats this trick with Suffragette City and the Gene Genie on subsequent albums. All of this is to say I don't think people generally appreciate how intelligent Bowie was at sequencing tracks on his records. The orchestrations on Hunky Dory are amazing, and Bowie performs intimate but hugely expressive vocals that are among his best. Rick Wakeman's piano on this album is also exceptional. So while I'd argue that Station to Station is perhaps more consistent song for song, Low is definitely more original and innovative, I think Hunky Dory just has some of Bowie's best ever compositions, and you get the range of his talent. It's a very intimate but epic album. At number one, and you may have guessed this from the very start, so I'm sorry for wasting all your time, it's Ziggy Stardust, or if you want its full title, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. Simply put, this is Bowie's masterpiece. It's one of the greatest rock and roll albums, not just of the 1970s, but of all time. It's a very theatrical, dramatic album. The central premise of a rock star alien coming to save a world that's told it's only got 5 years left to live. It's pitched brilliantly, even if the narrative is hard to pin down. And again, like Hunky Dory, the letter tracks are spaced out intelligently to help the album flow well. So you've got Soul Love, which sits between the epics of 5 years and Moon Age Daydream. Hang On to Yourself sits between key tracks Star and Ziggy Stardust. This album is perfectly paced. It's one of the few albums where every song is at the very least great. Mick Ronson shines on guitar throughout. And you can snark at some of the naff lyrics. I think that's one of the weak points of the album. But I think it's important to note for context that this was the era of glam rock, where you have Mark Bolan and T-Rex. And, you know, their daft lyrics were the order of the day. So it's kind of a stylistic, conscious choice from Bowie, I think. This album's a classic of the classic variety. This is the one I'd recommend everyone listens to, and it should belong in every collection. And that's the list, that's the Bowie list. My voice hurts after talking for so long now, but I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got a few insights. I hope you check out a few more of Bowie's albums if you're not that familiar with his entire discography. You'll know which ones to avoid now. I hope you enjoyed it.